Good afternoon, everyone. Special thanks for the special music this afternoon. Certainly a very meaningful hymn or song, very appropriate, and always a kind of a message in itself, a message of hope and looking forward to what will be accomplished by Jesus Christ and the Father that started with these days that we've been observing for the last week or so. So, again, thank you for that. Now, I told Mr. Martin that there was no announcements, and I didn't mean to lie. I just forgot. So I do apologize to all of you for this, but there is one announcement. Bob Bishop is asking the choir to please return all your music and copies of your music to him. And as soon as you return the music to him, he'll return your firstborn children. He's pretty serious about his inventory, so be sure to return. I don't know, maybe you wind up with a few extra kids, Bob. I don't know. Also wanted to mention that thank you for the offering this morning. We had an offering this morning of about $8,600. And that brings the total for the two holy days to just right at $18,000 between last week on the first day and today. So thank you very much for that, for your generous offering. And it's, as far as I know, it's already in the bank and probably on its way down to Texas. So thank you for participating in the holy day and for your generous offering this morning. So what's your exit plan for the Days of Unleavened Bread? An exit plan is a strategy that is for a transition from an activity or event when you reach a predetermined objective. You hear the phrase exit plan used from time to time, say for a military kind of a situation where there's some kind of an action that's going to be taken. And they know what they want to accomplish, and then they know what they want to do next. So what's your exit plan? I know you did a lot of planning before the Days of Unleavened Bread. Did a lot of time preparing, spent a lot of time preparing. But now that the week is over, what happens next? To put it another way, are you prepared for the end of the Days of Unleavened Bread? Last week at this time, we were prepared for the beginning of these days after quite a lot of effort. What happens now? Are you prepared for the end of the Days of Unleavened Bread? When our children were very young, I think our daughter was about 7, our son would have been about 5, toward the end of the week of Unleavened Bread, we sat down and I reminded them about how hard they had worked to help clean the house of all the leavening. After all, the crumbs that were scattered all throughout the place were mostly their fault. So we gave them an opportunity to participate. And so they spent quite a lot of time, in little children's, from a child's point of view, a lot of time and work cleaning all the crumbs and all the leavening out of the house. They had to empty out their toy boxes and carefully clean each of the toys that they had, clean their dressers all around their bedroom, help with the living room and the couches, the chairs. So as we got near the end of the Days of Unleavened Bread, I warned them the day before it was over that before the last holy day, we had to go through the house and completely clean all of the unleavened crumbs out of the house. They were crestfallen. Huge eyes, shoulders sagged, but only for a moment. My little son said, "Oh, Dad, come on." Pretty pathetic when you can't fool a 5-year-old. But but again, this evening at sunset, the Days of Unleavened Bread for 2018 will end. Then what? Do we just go back to the way things were? Well, in some ways, yeah, sure, we'll go back quickly to the way things were. It will quickly re-leaven our homes. Maybe you'll go out to dinner tonight for some pizza. Or at least you'll let them put croutons on your salad. Tomorrow, or Sunday, I should say, you can go to the store and load up on all the bread and baking soda and pancake mix. And probably you can meet up with Lou at Dunkin' Donuts. There's a lot that we'll go back to, a lot that will return to normal. But you know, there's not anything that we do physically to prepare for the end of the days of unleavened bread. Now, it's been emphasized several times today, and frankly, most of what I have to say is going to be just a review of what you've already heard in the other sermons and then the sermonette earlier today. But we know that the physical removal of leaven is only a symbol of something that is much deeper and much more permanent. The spiritual preparation before this week started was the real and the lasting lesson, and the physical effort was symbolic of that spiritual effort. As you went through a personal inventory and a self-examination prior to the Passover, prior to the days of unleavened bread, you almost certainly made some personal resolutions. You saw yourself a little more clearly in some area. You recognized the need, and you made a determined decision, a resolve to change and to make a complete or make it a permanent effort. So that's what I'm going to call our exit plan. The week is over, but the resolve continues. And what happens now is just as important as the preparation for these days that we're about to complete. So what I want to do then is to share with you some thoughts about some resolutions that we can keep in mind as we exit from the days of unleavened bread. Again, I'd very much appreciate both of the split sermons this morning and the sermonette this afternoon that touched on many of the same points from their perspective or point of view that I'm going to be emphasizing as well. And I have just four in mind, four thoughts or ideas. And as always, when we review a list of along this line, what I say might be helpful to you, but what might be most helpful is if what I say triggers some thoughts in your mind about what you would like to do for your exit plan, what you plan to do from now on as these days have come to their conclusion. So as I said, I have four resolutions that we can consider as we finish this week. The first resolution we might consider is resolve to continue coming out of sin. Resolve to continue coming out of sin. Again, life is such a pattern, isn't it? Life is basically a repetitive cycle. It gets interrupted often by different events, circumstances, things get turned around. But mostly life is a pattern that we've chosen for ourselves, that we're comfortable with, and that is just kind of the flow of our lives. The days of unleavened bread kind of interrupts that pattern. It pulls us back, we stop, we reconsider, we do something physical that changes our life around, and we do something mental or spiritual that really kind of captures our attention for this week. And probably all week long, you were very aware, very conscious of what you were doing physically, the need to avoid leavening, and that's a good thing. But there's also the more important and the deeper spiritual level. And I hope that at the same time you were avoiding the physical leaven, you were also giving thought to those areas in your life that you examined prior to the Passover, prior to the days of unleavened bread. And that now that we're completing these days, we won't settle directly or quickly back into those same old patterns in every sense. But there are some patterns that we will interrupt, that we will change. It will consciously make an effort to make something different in our lives. Turn back to Romans chapter 6. Paul here uses the analogy that we're familiar with about this time of year, the release from slavery. We know, of course, the story of Israel being led from and rescued from Egypt and from the physical slavery that they were in. Romans chapter 6, the first several verses, focuses on the ceremony of baptism and shows us the meaning of that ceremony. I want to just drop down and pick up a couple of verses. It talks in verses 3 and 4 about being buried with Jesus Christ and buried and raised, picturing his resurrection as well by the immersion in water. But verse 5 says that if we have been united together in the likeness of his death, certainly we shall be in the likeness of his resurrection. Knowing this, that our old man was crucified with him, that the body of sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves of sin. The old man, the old way of life, what we've repented of and begun, or we are continuing to change, going back to the time when God first began to work in our lives, is something that must die, not just be modified or not just be controlled, but is something which must end. It's a way, it's a pattern, it's habits or actions that need to cease. The old man, the old ways, the way prior to being called and converted and coming to repentance. That the body of sin might be done away with. Our physical body, in a sense, representing this death through baptism. But that body of sin, the old man, must be done away. And we are no longer, or we should no longer, be slaves of sin. Israel was delivered from physical slavery, excuse me, but they never escaped the bondage of sin. Israel came out of the physical bondage. They came out of Egypt. Sadly, they longed at times to go back into that slavery that they had been rescued from. But they came out of the physical slavery, but they never escaped the bondage of sin. They never really turned to God in obedience. Their history is a very sad one, of one event or time after the next of their sinful behavior and their rejection of the covenant that God had given to them. So Paul reminds us that we can come out of not just a physical situation, but spiritually, we can come out of and escape from the bondage of sin. Sin, sinful behavior, sinful life, is slavery. It is bondage to Satan and to his control. We have the opportunity to be rescued from that. And baptism, the receiving of the Holy Spirit, then is the path that God provides for us to come out of the bondage of sin. Turn over to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews, the 12th chapter. This bondage is described in a little different terminology here. We'll read verse 2. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. It says, "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." This is the emphasis that we had, of course, on the Passover, as we recognized and worshiped Jesus Christ as the one who, by his sacrifice, is the originator and the one who will complete and finish our path, our direction to God's kingdom. He endured what he did for our sake, and now sits at the right hand of God. But if we go back to, into verse 1, we see our part in this as well. First of all, he makes reference to the examples of faith that are in the previous chapter. And he said, with this in mind, in verse 1, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Lay aside the weight and sin which so easily ensnares us. We saw in Romans chapter 6 that sin is bondage or slavery. Here, we see that sin is a weight that holds us down or holds us back. Sin, or having sin that needs to be dealt with, is like trying to run with a heavy backpack, trying to run with a heavy weight on your back that slows you down, that holds you back, prevents you from making the progress that you want to make, that you need to make. It also says here that sin easily ensnares us. It is so easy to fall into a behavior or a thought pattern that is not within God's law. It's so easy for us to find ourselves in that situation. And as you reviewed and evaluated, examined yourself, you probably saw areas in your life where you are weighed down, held back, dominated by sin, and that it ensnares us, which means that it controls us. Sin controls a person. Sin dominates. Sin is a trap. We're ensnared by sin. So as we have examined ourselves and as we have made some discoveries about ourselves in areas in which we know and we very much want to improve, then we can see that there are areas in life that we need to gain control of and not allow sin to control us. It says to lay those things aside. Lay aside every weight of sin. To lay aside literally means to cast away or to throw away. To cast it away or throw it away. We treat it as if it is not something that has any value. We throw it away. We don't throw away something that has value. But sin, although sometimes it's difficult to give up, really has no value. It has no value at all. It's something that needs to be just tossed away. We toss away some of our household garbage every Monday night. And Tuesday morning, the trash collector comes by and takes away those things that we've cast away, that we're finished with, that we don't need, that are not of any value to us, that we don't want in our household anymore. Wouldn't it be nice if sin was that easy to deal with? Every Monday night, you just bag it up, all those things you got wrong the previous week, put it in one of those, maybe a recycle, no, I don't want to recycle it, put it in the garbage, and leave it at the curb, and somebody would come along and take it away for you. We realize sin has no value to us. It only harms us. It only holds us back. It dominates and controls us. It is a way that Satan has an entry, a place, a spot in our lives. We don't want that. We resent it. But it's just not that easy to simply cast it away, is it? It's not like a backpack, really. I said having sin is like trying to run with a backpack. Well, it's not that easy. You can't just take it off and set it aside. It's more like losing weight. It's really easy to gain weight. And we'd all could maybe run a little better, move a little better, be more comfortable if we lost a few pounds. But it's not so easy. Gaining weight is easy. Casting it off is difficult. And sin, because it's a snare, it's a trap, we get wrapped up in it. It's difficult for us to cast aside, yet it is something that we have resolved to deal with. There are areas in your life that you've resolved, you've noticed, and you've said to yourself, this is something that needs to be addressed, that's going to change. 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Paul uses a little bit different language here, but much the same point. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Verse 4, breaking into the middle of this thought here, Paul is talking about being a good soldier of Jesus Christ, to be committed to serving him in the same way that a soldier would be committed to the force that he's part of. Verse 4 says, "No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, so that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier." In this analogy, we are the soldiers of Jesus Christ, as he says in verse 3. To be a good soldier of Jesus Christ, remember this lesson, that if you're engaged in warfare, if you're a soldier in an army going into battle, you can't be distracted by anything except what your battle is all about. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life. He's dedicated to that battle that he's fighting. And if he's distracted by something else, he's not going to be an effective warrior. To entangle comes from a Greek word, which means to become so involved in an activity that you're restricted from what you need to do. To become involved in an activity that restricts you from what you want or what you need to do. In other words, it means to be wrapped up in something. It means to be involved in something that occupies your time, that draws you away from what the battle really is all about. To be entangled is to have that level of weight, to be ensnared, to be dominated, or to be controlled. That's something else about sin, isn't it? It controls. The things that we really are trying to overcome and working on, we find are pretty deeply embedded in a thought pattern or in a habit of some sort that's just very difficult to unwrap or to regain control of. So we give thought to what is it that really occupies our life? What is it that dominates and occupies our efforts, our thoughts, our concerns? Is it wrapped up in something that is drawing you away from rather than drawing you toward the battle that you really are involved in? I think the days of unleavened bread kind of helped to illustrate that this is a battle. This is a struggle. This is a fight. And it's something that is hard for us to control and to gain the upper hand. And it takes that real strength and resolve and determination if we're truly going to continue coming out of sin and to truly come out of bondage, again, in a way that Israel never did. Another scripture we can look at is Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8. Verse 10. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 10. This is in the middle of a quote from Jeremiah 31, in which there's a description of the new covenant and why the new covenant was necessary. Verse 7 says that the first covenant had a fault with it and had to be replaced. The fault was with the people. The fault was with those Israelites who came out of Egypt. As I said, they never came out of sin. They just came out of Egypt. And because they rejected the covenant, then that covenant needed then to be replaced. They broke it. They did not continue. It says in verse 9, they did not continue in my covenant, and I disregarded them, says the Lord. So the previous covenant, the old covenant, the one we find that Israel entered into with God in Exodus chapter 20, beginning in chapter 20, did not continue. And so he says in verse 10, "For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days." This is talking about a new covenant. Now, eventually, this new covenant will be offered to Israel through the course of God's plan. Certainly, it is a covenant that God enters into with us. When we receive God's Spirit, we become part of his church, part of the body of Jesus Christ. We enter into a personal covenant with God. And here's what is part of what happens. God says, verse 10, "I will put my laws in their mind and write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they shall be my people." As we continue to resolve to come out of sin, God is in the process of writing on our minds, or in our minds and on our hearts, writing his law within us, making it part of our character, part of our being. Not just part of our character, but it becomes our character to have his law in our mind and on our hearts. Again, it would be maybe a little more, maybe we would wish it could be easier. It's a little bit like putting sin off, putting God's law in to replace that sin that we are casting away is a process that takes time and effort. When we disentangle ourselves from sin, when we break away from that snare and set aside that weight, we put on, and rather, God's law in our minds and in our hearts. And we make it a priority to be obedient, to be worshipful, and to follow through on the resolve we have to change things in our lives so that we're in compliance with God's law. We might want to ask ourselves, why do we obey God? Why do we obey God? There are several different reasons why some would. A lot of people would obey God out of fear, just because they're afraid of God. That's not going to take a person very far. If obedience is only based on fear, if change is only based on fear, then that's not going to be lasting, because fear is not a positive motivator. We'll become exhausted, and we'll become discouraged, and we'll become angry even, that we just have to do certain things because we're afraid. They don't necessarily mean anything to us. We just realize we have to do it that way because God said. Do we obey God just because we kind of become compliant? Okay, we just kind of go along with what God says. And that's what we're supposed to do. And so we have maybe a more cooperative frame of mind or heart, not really fearing him, but just kind of going along. And it's not, obedience is not very deeply rooted. It's just a matter that, yeah, we know we should, and so we will. Everybody else around me is, so that's why I'll do it too. That kind of an approach is going to fail when the heat gets turned up, when things get difficult. But if we obey God from the heart because we want to be like he is, that's what matters. We choose to do what God says because we want to be like him, not because he threatens to punish us, not just because that's what everybody around you is doing in this particular peer group. But you obey God because you want to be like him. And you realize that his instruction tells you what his character is and what the character is that we are developing. Putting sin out is not just something we can superficially consider 1 week of the year. It's something that we focus on for this week and we carry through as we continue now into the rest of the year. So one of the things that we can resolve as we conclude these days, is that we will continue. This idea of coming out of sin is not just pictured by one event in the book of Exodus, of one nation coming out of Israel coming out of Egypt. It pictures our life and what our life is about and will continue to be, that we will come out of the slavery of sin. There's the lesson, of course, a lot of lessons. Let's look at another one we can learn from the people of ancient Israel's experience, and another resolution that we can make based on what they, based on that example. As we come out of the days of unleavened bread, we can resolve not to be overwhelmed when life gets difficult. Resolve not to be overwhelmed when life gets difficult. You know, Israel didn't have much of an exit plan. Israel didn't have much of a clue. They were thrilled to get out of Egypt, but they really didn't have an idea of what was going to happen next. And when life became difficult, then they were immediately overwhelmed. Let's go back and look at an example. We saw one earlier today about how Israel balked at entering into the promised land. Let's go back a little earlier in this sequence, back to Exodus 14. We'll see how Israel responded when they came up to the Red Sea. Pharaoh's army was right behind them. They were trapped between his army and the Red Sea, and we know the story. I'm not going to read the entire account, but they panicked. They panicked when they were in this situation. When life became difficult, they were very overwhelmed. Let's pick it up in verse 10 here in Exodus 14. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way to bring us out of Egypt? Actually, a little bit of a sarcastic result there, response there, isn't it? You know, there weren't enough graves to kill us all in Egypt, so you brought us out here into the wilderness to die. Is this not the word, verse 12, that we told you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. Initially, you'll remember, they balked when Moses came to them. When he first came to them and told them that he was going to go to Pharaoh to ask if they would be released to go into the wilderness just for 3 days to offer offerings to their God, Pharaoh made their life miserable. He made them continue building the bricks they were responsible for, but they had to get their own straw. And they were held to the same quota, and they were in a very serious condition. And they came back to Moses and they said, leave us alone. What have you done to us? You've made our life worse than it was in the first place. That's what they're referring to here. They told Moses when life was difficult for them in Egypt to leave them alone, and they would stay in Egypt after all. So now, after all that they went through to get released from Egypt, they find themselves trapped at the shore of the Red Sea, and seemingly there was no escape from that situation. But, of course, we know that God opened up the Red Sea miraculously, and they walked through to the other side with, as Mr. Westfall pointed out, the guys in the back saying, hurry up, let's go. So, based on this experience, get dropped down to verse 30. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. And everyone lived happily ever after. At this moment, the people of Israel were convinced. They recognized, they realized what God had done for them. They gave some thought to how they got there. They saw what God had done to the Egyptian army, the great work that he had accomplished, that he had miraculously delivered them. And there they were on the other side now of the Red Sea, looking at the dead bodies of these soldiers who had come after them. But this is another example of one of the points that was given in the sermonette. They didn't remember. They didn't remember what God had done. Turn to Psalm 106. This is one of those psalms that summarizes some of the history of Israel as they came out of Egypt and into the wilderness. Psalm 106, begin in verse 7. Psalm 106, verse 7, says, "Our fathers in Egypt did not understand your wonders. They did not remember the multitude of your mercies, but rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea." Israel didn't really appreciate, understand, or acknowledge the miracles that God was performing that brought them to the point where they would be released from Egypt. They were excited about getting out from underneath the oppression, but they didn't really understand. They didn't really get it. They didn't know. Verse 8, "Nevertheless, he saved them for his name's sake." God had promised Abraham that he would bring his descendants to Canaan and give them this land that was promised. So for his name's sake, not because the people understood or worshipped or honored him, but for his name's sake, he brought them out that he might make his mighty mighty power known. Verse 9, "He rebuked the Red Sea also, and it dried up, and he led them through the depths as through the wilderness. He saved them from the hand of him who hated them and redeemed them from the hand of the enemy. The waters covered their enemies. There was none of them left." Verse 12, "Then they believed his words and they sang his praise." That's what we just saw in Numbers 14. And chapter 15 is what's called the Song of Moses and the prayer or the praise of God for what he had performed on their behalf. So that's where we left off, that they feared and believed God. But then verse 12 is the key here. Verse 13, I mean, "They soon forgot his works." They did not remember what God had done for them. A point that we can consider and remember as we move forward from the days of unleavened bread is that life is going to we're going to have a lot of giants to face. We're going to have a lot of issues to deal with. Our life itself will be threatened at times. But resolve not to be overwhelmed, not to forget as Israel did. Israel's life became very difficult very quickly. Turn back again to Exodus 15. We were reading in chapter 14 where God had brought them through the Red Sea and they feared and believed God. Chapter 15 begins with this song of praise that was mentioned in Psalm 106 that the people shared, that Moses led them in. Drop down to verse 22 in Exodus 15. "So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name was called Marah," which means bitter. "And the people complained against Moses, saying, 'What shall we drink?'" The point I'll make here is that life can become difficult very quickly. Life can turn around and become very threatening, very frightening, very quickly. The people of Israel were overwhelmed by this crisis. The Hebrew word complain, it says they complained to Moses. The Hebrew word that's translated there means to be obstinate. So they were kind of digging in their heels and resisting Moses and resisting God, for that matter. They complained. A complaint is an accusation of unfair treatment. In effect, they were accusing God. Complaining is something that's pretty easy for us to do. When our life is difficult, we may have some things we feel justified to complain about. If we express our dissatisfaction or our annoyance with God by complaining, then that's a sign that we're overwhelmed by those circumstances. We're accusing God, if we complain, of treating us unfairly. That, of course, is a form of doubt. Doubting God's concern, his care, doubting that he will show that care for us in our time of need. And yet complaining is a natural thing to us, and I think that it's something that all of us find ourselves in that frame of mind of just feeling like we have something in our lives that we just that feel is not fair, it's not right, it's not proper, it's not understandable, and we begin to complain. Remember what we committed to if we look at Luke 14, verse 27. Luke chapter 14, verse 27. When we got into this outfit, we were led through this particular passage in Luke 14. We reviewed at some point in most likely in baptism counseling this point that Jesus made in this here in Luke 14, verse 27. Whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. The burdens of life can be heavy. The burdens of life can come upon us suddenly and unexpectedly and can be very threatening and dangerous. But the burdens of life are things that Jesus Christ told us we, as his disciples, must be willing to carry as we continue to follow him. We must continue to follow him even though those burdens become heavy. The path to life, we know, is narrow and difficult. We have our ups and downs. And we need, as Jesus put it, to be willing to carry our cross or carry our burdens. Israel faced those obstacles shortly after leaving Egypt, and they were overwhelmed. The last couple of sermons, we've been talking about God's will in our lives. And we know that from God's perspective, everything he is doing is for the purpose of bringing us to the point where we can be in his kingdom. That's his goodwill. That's his pleasure. That's what he is all about, is preparing us for his kingdom. And that does include situations that will strengthen us in our character and strengthen us in our faith. So we carry those burdens, but don't be overwhelmed. Recognize, realize that those events, those things are going to happen. Those giants are out there, but God is right here. And he's the one who will bring us through those circumstances. It's a mindset, it's a point of view, it's a realization, it's an expression of faith. Let's consider a third area that we could consider as an important resolution to make as we finish up this week. Resolve to avoid distractions. Resolve to avoid distractions. Again, the days of unleavened bread provide us with a real focused period of time in which our concentration, our thoughts are continually on what we're doing physically and hopefully the lesson that is teaching us spiritually. But maintaining our focus on God's kingdom can be very challenging. As I said, life is a routine, and we're about to go back into that more normal routine. And it's easy for us to become distracted by, as we saw that sin is all about. It's something that ensnares us. It's something that we can become entangled in, whether it's actually sin or just other aspects of life that are distracting. We all realize how important it is not to let other things get in the way of what our goal truly is. That is, of course, the kingdom of God and his righteousness. So resolve to avoid distractions. And that part of that would be just to recognize that there are distractions. And to realize that if I'm not careful, I could be drawn back in or I could be drawn away from. My focus could be changed. A resolution is basically a mindset, isn't it? It's just a matter that we realize and we set our mind to deal with something in a particular way. In this case, to avoid things that could otherwise distract us. Keep in mind this very familiar phrase. We've repeated it often, but I think it's fitting. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. Our attention is easily drawn to something else. But the main thing that we need to be focused on is to keep the main thing the main thing. Maintaining focus is very difficult. But you know, that's why God gives us so much holy time. Have you thought about how much holy time God has allocated in our lives? We have the weekly Sabbath. One day out of seven is holy time. And that's about 14% of your life is the weekly Sabbath. And the command, of course, is remember the Sabbath to keep it holy, which means that we observe it one day of the week, but we're always aware of it. We're always learning the lesson from it, and we're always focused toward the observance of the Sabbath. The Sabbath takes up about 14% of our time. In addition to that, there are seven annual Sabbaths. Seven annual Sabbaths on top of, say, 52 weekly Sabbaths. Now, once in a while, there's going to be a Sabbath and a holy day that are on the same day. So let's say that there are, say, 58 times a year that we'll be observing a Sabbath, either a weekly Sabbath or an annual Sabbath. That's about 16% of your time. You're never more than 6 days away from the Sabbath. And we're never more than a few months away from an annual Sabbath that have a very special significance to us. It helps us to avoid distraction, to keep on track, to be reminded constantly. Now, if you include in this holy time the days during unleavened bread and during the Feast of Tabernacles that aren't technical, they aren't Sabbaths, they're not holy time in the same sense. But if you include those, then you've got another 12 days, because some of those days were Sabbaths. If you total up all these days that are holy time, that's about 20% of your life is holy time. 80% belongs to you to do your work, to do what needs to be done. But you know what? What is our work? Our work becomes staying focused on God's calling and working toward his kingdom. So if 20% of our life is actually holy time, but it turns out that pretty much 100% of our life has to do with being focused on God's calling and God's kingdom. We never should stray from that. And we live in a world that is filled with distractions. That's what Satan is so good at. He's created a whole world of distraction. So many ways our attention can be drawn away. So many ways that our life can be focused improperly. other distractions too. Jesus warned about the cares of this life. In Luke 21:34, he warns us not to be drawn away by our own personal weaknesses or by the cares of this life. The cares of this life is kind of an interesting phrase. Basically, the word care means, in this case, a distress or an anxiety. A distress or anxiety. Sometimes things in life are difficult for us, and we become stressed by those things. They become a focus of our attention. We can be distracted by our personal hobbies and interests. We can be distracted by noises in the room next door. There are so many things vying for our attention. Attention span is defined as the amount of concentrated time a person can spend without being distracted. We hear about how attention span is being reduced constantly by various influences, mostly including entertainment and electronic screens and so on. Our attention span is basically shrinking. The normal attention span for an adult is 15 to 20 minutes. That means I lost all of you about half an hour ago. Most people can stay focused for a relatively brief period of time. But God gives us the opportunity to stay focused on Him. I hope you see the value in that holy time. You know, in Deuteronomy 5, where the Sabbath is described in that particular chapter, it talks about how the Sabbath is to remind us that we were slaves in Egypt. Now, it's talking specifically to the Israelites as they came from Egypt. It's not the same literal instruction to us. And yet, the Sabbath does remind us that we've been called and we've been given understanding. We've been given a special connection with God that's important to us. And He maintains that connection with us every week on His Sabbath day. So I hope you see the value and that you make appropriate effort to be part of the services that are provided, even on a weekly basis. That's part of that routine, you know. And the Sabbath is the Sabbath, and it's the same thing, same observance every week. And even that can become a routine. Even that can become something that maybe we're not really entirely focused on. Being able to attend a Sabbath service is a real privilege. And I hope it's something that you do value, and that it's something that you are willing to put out the effort. A lot of thoughts come to mind when I think about that particular specific point of attending a Sabbath service. But I think that, for the most part, our members do realize that value and the importance of it. But frankly, I'll just acknowledge that there are times when Sabbath attendance kind of slacks off. Sabbath attendance can be sometimes not as strong as it might be. Now, I don't mean to be critical or unfair. There are times when people have illness or physical problems, then they are not able to attend services. There are times when we visit family. There are times when we visit other congregations. But I'll just leave it at this, that Sabbath attendance is something that is very important. The Sabbath each week is a holy convocation. That is where God is. And that's where we want to be as well, with Him at His service as He gathers His people together, and to be with one another, be with our brethren who share that understanding. So, just a word, be careful to avoid distractions that would limit us in our opportunities to be together. I won't take the time to go to Hebrews 5, verse 11, but in it we find a very stern warning about not becoming dull of hearing. That's a matter of distraction as well. Hebrews 5, verse 11 suggests that those that were receiving this epistle were not able to appreciate all of the message that could have been given to them because they'd become dull of hearing, or lazy or sluggish, is what the word means. He points out in this verse that those who to whom he was writing by that point should have been spiritually mature, but they weren't because they had become dull of hearing. So it's another symptom of being distracted, of not being focused. Being dull of hearing is a spiritual weakness that can lead to serious problems. So, as we come out of this week, when we've been so focused and so concentrated, consider your resolution or a resolution to avoid being distracted. I'll just quickly mention one last point. Don't have much time to spend, but one last resolution we can make and consider that I think is part of the holy days and part of the Sabbath and part of our connection to one another. Resolve to draw closer to your brethren. Resolve to draw closer to your brethren. Remember, we just had the Passover service, which includes the foot washing ceremony. And part of that foot washing ceremony includes the instruction of Jesus Christ in John chapter 14. John chapter 13, verse 14, where Jesus, after washing the feet of his disciples, said, "If I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. I've given you an example that you should do as I have done." Later in the same chapter, he says that he's given his disciples a new commandment to love one another as he loved us. Just last week, you washed the feet of one of your brethren, if you're a baptized member. It's something we do once a year, but it's a year-long and lifelong lesson. Jesus expects us to learn from his example and to love one another, to be willing to sacrifice and give of ourselves, of our time, our concern for one another, to love as he has loved us. As we await the return of Jesus Christ, there's a particular emphasis we'll find in the book of James, chapter 4. James chapter 5. Okay, so it's John 13 and James 5. Got it. James 5, verse 7. It says, "Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. You also be patient and establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." So, obviously, as we wait for the return of Jesus Christ, we're patient. That involves being willing to endure and being willing to wait and to have faith as we await the return of Jesus Christ. But notice in the same context, he says in verse 9, "Do not grumble against one another, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." So it's still the same context of awaiting anxiously the return of Jesus Christ. But not only do we wait anxiously for him to return, but we also are focused on our relationship, our connection to one another. It says, "Do not grumble against one another." Do not have harsh words toward one another. The word grumble in the margin says to groan, or to have complaint against one another. Then it speaks again of the endurance of the patience of the prophets. But the connection is made between our relationship with one another as we await the return of Jesus Christ. We find ourselves in a very stressful situation, don't we, in the world that we live in. A lot of stress, a lot of concern, a lot of anxiety about events in the world. And as we see things happening, we anxiously await the return of Jesus Christ. Don't disregard personal relationships, but be patient with one another as well. Ephesians 2, verse 20 talks about how we're being fitted together as the temple of God, the place where the Holy Spirit dwells. Drawing together as brethren is an important part of what we can focus on as we move forward to complete the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Days of Unleavened Bread. So I've given you a little bit to think about, some consideration for lessons we can learn and take with us as we finish this week. Again, there's no physical preparation for the end of the Days of Unleavened Bread. Tonight at sunset, it just ends. And we move on. The calendar page turns. The Days of Unleavened Bread are completed. But hopefully, what we've learned from the Days of Unleavened Bread doesn't go away with the turn of a calendar page. We continue to dwell on and to apply the things that we've had a chance to be part of. Let's conclude in Luke chapter 14, verse 28. Luke 14. We read it. The previous verse a minute ago. Luke 14, verse 28. It's a reminder that, again, when we made the commitment to Jesus Christ, we considered the fact that there's going to be some challenge, there's going to be some effort, and it's necessary for us to realize that this is a task that's going to be life-consuming. Luke 14, verse 28. Which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? You counted the cost. You decided that you were willing to pay the cost. And now, we're in the middle of that building project. Now, that tower is being built. Now, we continue to learn lessons as we focus on one aspect here as we complete this particular festival season. We are reminded of some of what that cost is. The cost is our effort. The cost basically is our life. Jesus gave his life for us, and now we in turn give our life to him through our efforts and through our dedication. The week is over. They always go so quickly, don't they? Tomorrow you can have toast for breakfast. Whoopee. Not to make light of what God has us do, but a reminder that that was the physical part. So as we complete this week, make sure that it is a turning point. Give thought to your determination and resolve to make this a permanent effort to resolve and to make permanent changes in your life, to put your exit plan to work.